since we don't ignore the days of appearance and disappearance of great Vaishnavas. Since ISKCON is an extension of Prabhupada's mission, it's a special day, it's on the calendar, and we'll talk about it. Or I'll try to read something and then speak something. As I was there at the time in New York, so this event is cataloged in the Srila Prabhupada Lilamrita quite nicely, and I'll try to add a few comments about it, and maybe some of you have thought about this and want to say some things. It would be interesting to hear different opinions about this. So I'll read another comment. This is from Prabhupada Lilamrita also. And this chapter is called Breaking Ground. We shall call our society ISKCON. Prabhupada had laughed playfully when he first coined the acronym. It's interesting that Prabhupada decided upon an acronym because in certain places there have been people identify the devotees with ISKCON. They just say, oh, it's just, I've heard him say ISKCON. And somehow that acronym, which is distinctly an American way of designating a company, kind of stuck. And so some vendors, like people work in stationery stores and all, they want to know, oh, is it ISKCON? They sort of identify Hare Krishna and the devotees with what they call ISKCON. He had initiated the legal work of incorporation that spring while still living on the Bowery. But even before its legal beginning, he had been talking about his, quote, International Society for Krishna Consciousness, end quote. And so it appeared in letters to India and in the Village Voice. A friend had suggested a title that would sound more familiar to Westerners, International Society for Krishna Consciousness, International Society for God Consciousness. But Prabhupada had insisted, Krishna Consciousness. And I was the person who suggested this. I don't know why they didn't use my name, because I'm not embarrassed to say it. And I don't think I can be sued for it. But I thought that Krishna was too foreign and too unfamiliar, and that it wouldn't be a good name, and that International Society for God Consciousness would be a good name. And then at that time, Kirtananda was at, Prabhupada asked him, well, what do you think? I'm going to call it International Society for Krishna Consciousness, and Kirtananda Nanda said that he thought Krishna Consciousness was better, and then Prabhupada said, yes, I like that better. So that was the end of the conversation. Prabhupada insisted Krishna Consciousness. God was a vague term, whereas Krishna was exact and scientific. God consciousness was spiritually weaker, less personal. And if Westerners didn't know that Krishna was God, then the International Society for Krishna Consciousness would tell them by spreading his glories in every town and village. Krishna consciousness was Prabhupada's own rendering of a phrase from Srila Rupa Goswami's Padyavali, written in the 16th century Krishna Bhakti Rasa Bhavita, quote, to be absorbed in the mellow taste of executing devotional service to Krishna. But to register ISKCON legally as a non-profit tax-exempt religion required money and a lawyer. Carl Jurgens had already gained some experience in forming religious, political, and social welfare groups. And when he had met Prabhupada on the Bowery, he had agreed to help. He had contacted his lawyer, Stephen Goldsmith. Stephen Goldsmith, a young Jewish lawyer with a wife and two children and an office on Park Avenue, was interested in spiritual movements. When Carl told him about Prabhupada's plans, he was immediately fascinated by the idea of setting up a religious corporation for an Indian Swami. He visited Prabhupada at 26 Second Avenue, and they discussed incorporation, tax exemption, Prabhupada's immigration status, and Krishna consciousness. Mr. Goldsmith visited Prabhupada several times. Once he brought his children, who liked the, quote, soup, end quote, Swami cooked. He began attending the evening lectures, where he was often the only non-hippie member of the congregation. One evening, having completed all the legal groundwork and being ready to complete the procedures for incorporation, Mr. Goldsmith came to Prabhupada's lecture and kirtan to get signatures from the trustees of the new society. Prabhupada is lecturing, July 11th. Mr. Goldsmith, wearing slacks and a shirt and tie, sits on the floor near the door, listening earnestly to the lecture, despite the distracting noises from the neighborhood. Prabhupada has been explaining how scholars mislead innocent people with non-devotional interpretations of the Bhagavad Gita, and now, in recognition of the attorney's respectable presence, and as if to catch Mr. Goldsmith's attention better, he introduces him into the subject of the talk. I will give you a practical example of how things are misinterpreted. Just like our president, Mr. Goldsmith, he knows that expert lawyers, by interpretation, can do so many things. When I was in Calcutta, there was a rent tax passed by the government, and some expert lawyer changed the whole thing by his interpretation. The government had to reenact the whole law because their purpose was foiled by the interpretation of this lawyer. So we are not out for foiling the purpose of Krishna, for which the Bhagavad Gita was spoken. But unauthorized persons are trying to foil the purpose of Krishna. Therefore, that is unauthorized. All right, Mr. Goldsmith, you can ask anything. Mr. Goldsmith stands, and to the surprise of the people gathered, he makes a short announcement asking for signers on an incorporation document for the Swami's new religious movement, Prabhupada. They are present here. You can take the addresses now. Mr. Goldsmith, I can take them now. Yes, Prabhupada. Yes, you can. Bill, you can give your address. And Raphael, you can give yours. And Don, Roy, Mr. Green. As the meeting breaks up, those called on to sign as trustees come forward, standing around in the little storefront, waiting to leaf cursorily through the pages the lawyer has produced from his main attaché and to sign as he directs, yet not a soul among them is committed to Krishna consciousness. Mr. Goldsmith meets his quota of signers, a handful of sympathizers with enough reverence toward the Swami to want to help him. The first trustees who will hold office for a year until the first annual meeting of the corporation are Michael Grant, who puts down his name and address without even reading the document, Mike's girlfriend Jan, and James Green. No one seriously intends to undertake any formal duties as trustee of the religious society, but they are happy to help the Swami by signing his fledgling society into existence. According to law, a second group of trustees will assume office for the second year. They are Paul Gardiner, Roy, and Don. Trustees for the third year are Carl Jurgens, Bill Epstein, and Raphael. None of them know exactly what the half a dozen legal-sized type pages mean, except that Swamiji is forming a society, quote-unquote. Why? For tax exemption, in case someone gives a big donation, and for other benefits an official religious society might receive. But these purposes hardly seem urgent or even relevant to the present situation. Who's going to make donations, except maybe for Mr. Goldsmith, who has any money? I don't know if it's in here, but at one point when I was in the temple, Mr. Goldsmith stood up and asked a kind of a non-sequitur kind of question. He asked Prabhupada, if God is so benevolent and kind, why is he sending so many of our young boys to Vietnam? And Prabhupada immediately answered by saying, your countrymen are killing so many cows, therefore God is saying, send your sons to the slaughterhouse. And he kind of pointed as he said, send your sons to the slaughterhouse. And everyone was kind of like awestruck. You know, here was this non-hippie with his tie and suit standing up asking a very logical question. And Prabhupada really was very strong in his answer. And it was kind of a shocking answer, but everybody kind of quieted down. There were no further questions on the topic because it made a lot of sense. But Prabhupada is planning for the future, and he's planning for much more than just tax exemption. He's trying to serve his spiritual predecessors and fulfill the scriptural prediction of a spiritual movement that is to flourish for 10,000 years in the midst of the age of Kali. Within the vast Kali age, a period which is to last 432,000 years, the 1960s are but an insignificant moment. The Vedas describe that the time of the universe revolves through a cycle of four seasons or yugas, and Kali Yuga is the worst of times, in which all spiritual qualities of men diminish until humanity is finally reduced to a bestial civilization devoid of human decency. However, the Vedic literature foretells a golden age of spiritual life, beginning after the advent of Lord Chaitanya and lasting for 10,000 years, an eddy that runs against the current of Kali Yuga. with a vision that soars off to the end of the millennium and beyond. Yet with his 2 feet solidly on the ground of Second Avenue, Prabhupada has begun an international society for Krishna consciousness. He has many practical responsibilities, paying the rent, incorporating his society, and paving the way for a thriving worldwide congregation of devotees. Yet he doesn't see his humble beginning as limiting the greater scope of his divine mission. He knows that everything depends on Krishna, so whether he succeeds or fails is up to the Supreme. He has only to try. The purposes stated within ISKCON's articles of incorporation reveal Prabhupada's thinking. There were 7 points similar to those given in the prospectus for the League of Devotees he formed in Jhansi, India, in 1953. The attempt had been unsuccessful, yet his purposes remained unchanged. 7 purposes of the International Society of Krishna Consciousness. A. To systematically propagate spiritual knowledge to society at large and to educate all peoples in the techniques of spiritual life. In order, you know these by heart? In order to check the imbalance of values in life and achieve real unity and peace in the world. One of the courses asks the devotees to learn all these 7 points that's being taught by, I think, Rasamandala. B. To propagate a consciousness of Krishna as it is revealed in the Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. C. To bring the members of the society together with each other and nearer to Krishna, the prime entity, thus to develop the idea within the members and humanity at large that each soul is part and parcel of the quality of Godhead, Krishna. To teach and encourage the Sankirtan movement, congregational chanting of the holy name of God as revealed in the teachings of Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. E. To erect for the members and for society at large a holy place of transcendental pastimes dedicated to the personality of Krishna. F. To bring the members closer together for the purpose of teaching a simpler and more natural way of life. G. With a view towards achieving the aforementioned purposes, to publish and distribute periodicals, magazines, books, and other writings. Regardless of what ISKCON's charter members thought of the society's purposes, Prabhupada saw them as imminent realities. As Mr. Rubin, the subway conductor who had met Prabhupada on the Manhattan Park Bench in 1965, had noted, he seems to know that he would have temples filled up with devotees. There are temples and books, he said. They are existing. They are here, but the time is separating us from them. The first purpose mentioned in the charter was propagation. Preaching was the word Prabhupada most often used. For him, preaching had a much broader significance than mere sermonizing. Preaching meant glorious, selfless adventures on behalf of the Supreme Lord. Lord Chaitanya had preached by walking all over southern India and causing thousands of people to chant and dance with him in ecstasy. Lord Krishna had preached the Bhagavad Gita while standing with Arjuna in his chariot on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. Lord Buddha had preached, Lord Jesus had preached, and all pure devotees preach. ISKCON's preaching would achieve what the League of Nations and the United Nations had failed to achieve, real unity and peace in the world. ISKCON workers would bring peace to a world deeply afflicted by materialism and strife. They would systematically propagate spiritual knowledge, knowledge of the non-sectarian science of God. It was not that a new religion was being born in July of 1966. Rather, the eternal preaching of Godhead, known as Sankirtan, was being transplanted from east to west. The society's members would join together, and by hearing the teachings of Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, and by chanting the Hare Krishna mantra, they would come to realize that each was a spirit soul eternally related to Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. They would then preach this to, quote, humanity large, end quote, especially through Sankirtan, the chanting of the holy name of God. ISKCON would also erect a holy place of transcendental pastimes dedicated to the personality of Krishna. Was this something beyond the storefront? Yes, certainly. He never thought small. He seemed to know that he would have temples filled up with devotees. He wanted ISKCON to demonstrate a simple, more natural way of life. Such a life, Prabhupada thought of the villages in India where people lived just as Krishna had lived, was most conducive to developing Krishna consciousness. And all 6 of these purposes would be achieved by the 7th. ISKCON would publish and distribute literature. This was the special instruction Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur had given to Srila Prabhupada. He had specifically told him one day in 1932 at Radha Kunda in Vrindavan, if you ever get money, publish books. Certainly none of the signers saw any immediate shape to the Swami's dream. Yet these seven purposes were not only theistic rhetoric invented to convince a few New York State government officials. Prabhupada meant to enact that every item in the charter. Of course, he was now working in extremely limited circumstances. The principal place of worship, located at 26 Second Avenue in the city, county, and state of New York, was the sole headquarters for the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. Yet Prabhupada insisted that he was not living at 26 Second Avenue, New York City. His vision was transcendental. His Guru Maharaj had gone out from the traditional holy places of spiritual meditation to preach in cities like Calcutta, Bombay, and Delhi. And yet Prabhupada would say that his spiritual master had not really been living in any of those cities, but was always in Vaikuntha, the spiritual world, because of his absorption in devotional service. Similarly, the place of worship, 26 Second Avenue, was not a New York storefront, a former curiosity shop. The storefront and the apartment had been spiritualized and were now a transcendental haven. Society at large, quote-unquote, could come here. The whole world could take shelter here, regardless of race or religion. Plain, small, and impoverished as it was, Prabhupada regarded the storefront as, quote, a holy place of transcendental pastimes dedicated to the personality of Krishna, end quote. It was a world headquarters, a publishing house, a sacred place of pilgrimage, and a center from which an army of devotees could issue forth and chant the holy names of God in all the streets of the world. The entire universe could receive Krishna consciousness from the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, which was beginning here. So that place, 26 Second Avenue, is still a temple. And the devotees have made it into a temple and they hold regular programs there. And they've kind of refurbished it, made it a nice floor, and put pictures on the wall, and there's signs also there. So if you ever go to New York, it's definitely worth visiting. I call it where it all began. when I was in England, Prabhupada asked that we do the same. It was, I think, first non-American country where Krishna consciousness was to be established. So one of the first things he ordered us to do was to incorporate the society. And at the time, I had a part-time job, and at my lunch hour, I had to assemble this and mail it to him to show him what we were doing. So it took about 9 months to get the tax exemption in England. First, we got it incorporated. And at first, the Charity Commission refused to honor our 7 points and said that we couldn't make a tax exempt. And we used the law firm that was then acting for the Prime Minister, who was then Harold Wilson in England. And we thought we had the best legal advice. And when we heard that it wasn't approved for charitable status, we became very disheartened. I remember having a conversation with one of the lawyers, and he was saying, we got a letter back from the Charity Commission. I said, oh, that's great. He said, well, it's not so great. And then he told me the bad news. So, but he said, but we'll try anyway. We'll write another letter. We'll persist. And finally, they wrote back and said, well, it's a borderline case, but they granted us tax exemption. So we had that, and Prabhupada was happy. Then when he went to India, I had to... These are the same purposes that we're reading here that were incorporated in England, which they said was a borderline case. Then we had to do the same thing in India. And I just remember I was rushing to the post office one day, and I was running across the street somewhere in the center of London and fell. And I had a briefcase with all of the papers in it that were going to be mailed in the post office. And I saw that the briefcase skittering along the pavement in front of me across a bunch of cars. It was in a very busy intersection. I thought, oh my gosh, what if a car runs over this? And somehow it didn't. And I was somehow thinking more about the briefcase than I was going to get run over by a car. But it was all right in the middle of an intersection. And somehow it didn't get run over, and I got up and picked up the briefcase and posted it. And then after all that, somehow it didn't get there. Either it got stolen in a post office in India, or for some reason it never got there. Prabhupada was concerned, so I had to mail it again. And then finally it was incorporated in India. So this is an indication that it was all very important to Srila Prabhupada that these papers be filed, and that has become a legal entity. Some people would say that, oh, well, why should you incorporate a religious society? It's spiritual. You've been on Krishna. You don't have to have it legally incorporated. But Prabhupada was very, very keen to do this. And it wasn't only, as we heard, just to satisfy certain people in the government, but he had a purpose. In a sense, Prabhupada, for many years, was acting as the CEO of an international corporation. Wherever he was advising devotees on legal and financial matters constantly. And even though that's considered somewhat mundane, Prabhupada was up to his neck, so to speak, in doing these kinds of things, in writing letters. And that's in addition to writing every day. He was in the night very often, writing his books. He was having darshans. He was advising devotees about the personal and social matters constantly. And through all this, there were very complex legal and financial things that would constantly arise. Sometimes on the other side of the world from where he was located, and he would very patiently and very adroitly write them and propose how to solve these very, sometimes very complicated matters that involve purchasing properties, lawsuits, getting permission to do things like having Sankirtan and have a temple in a particular house. Some were extremely complicated, and they would baffle even great legal minds today. And Prabhupada single-handedly would write letters. Even when he was giving a darshan, he would have a certain time of the day when he would write letters, and sometimes he would answer 15 or 20 a day. And they would all be very technical matters, dealing with a society that was incorporated and had to get exemption. So country by country, ISKCON was incorporated, starting with America, then England, then India, and then all in many, many, many places. And after it was done, it became apparent why Prabhupada was so keen to have it done, that there were donations that did become tax-exempt, and many people would only give to organizations that were tax-exempt. So by and by, it became apparent why Prabhupada was insisting upon incorporation. Another point here is that Prabhupada organized, he was an organizer, and while certain spiritualists and pseudo-spiritualists from India say that absolute power corrupts absolutely, or that institutions become irreversibly corrupt after some time, Prabhupada defied all that and formed a society and insisted, not only insisted that it be formed, but insisted that it be the central stabilizing measure. He created a board, he created a governing body commission, and he actually asked the devotees to do what many people think is impossible. He asked them to discuss matters together, like I suppose boards are supposed to do, and arrive at conclusions. There was a rotating chairman. Most people think that successful organizations tend to be driven by an individual, Walt Disney, many other Fortune 500 companies. But Prabhupada's method was that he would select a group and that he would ask this group to discuss things, threadbare if necessary, until they reached a higher understanding. And many people thought this was impossible. In fact, there are some of Prabhupada's godbrothers and other leaders, and some of Prabhupada's initiated disciples even follow them, who do not understand that there's a corporation. They don't understand that Prabhupada was the CEO of a corporation, besides being a great acharya and saint. They don't understand how a group of people who have, especially at that time, had very little experience with running or operating a large organization with international dimensions and very, very different cultures from one another, could function. So that consciousness is not there in many of Prabhupada's contemporaries. So Prabhupada did start something unique. In fact, it's been an opinion of some people to start a Prabhupada Sampradaya, just to call it a Prabhupada Sampradaya. That may be a bit extreme. But the idea is that ISKCON has proven itself over the years to have done unique things. For the first time, a spiritual movement has been taken outside of India. Temples, Some of them of great magnitude have been erected. The deities have been established, beautiful deities, and deity worship has been established. Many people don't understand why we spend so much money on them, on their flowers, on their clothes, on their worship, on boga, on the kitchen, and why we're adoring them with such elaborate expenses. Why we're spending so much money for gasoline and petrol and constantly going places. There are a lot of people, I know this from my experience in fundraising, who don't understand why are they doing that. So Prabhupada was very convinced that this would be the measure of his success, that there would be deities that would be beautiful beyond compare, that they would be adored and adorned, and that the prasadam would be irresistible. And in this way, by spending a lot more than many others, say, for example, Hindu temples are willing to do, many, many thousands, billions, well, thousands anyway, would join. Maybe millions, because we don't issue plastic cards for members, and many people consider themselves members who we might not even see, but they're convinced about ISKCON and its philosophy. So Prabhupada was that. He incorporated for the purpose of being, it was part of his mission to establish temples like this all over the world, and they would become the bulwark, so to speak, the basis, the foundation of his movement. So as I was saying, he, in one sense, asked people to do the impossible, to work as a group, and only very progressive organizations, profit or non-profit, even do that today. Generally, they're driven by a visionary person. So Prabhupada had faith in his disciples that they would band together and do the right things. That was the way he set up his society, his ISKCON. And it's very interesting, some of the points in the 7 points that he talked about. To bring the members closer together for the purpose of teaching a simpler and more natural way of life. So this is also very much on people's minds. Sometimes see this New Zealand Herald that talks about the core values. They're having a debate. They call it core, like C-O-R-E, core values debate. Well, what are the core values? And maybe the core is missing. And maybe that's why there's not a more simple and natural way of life. I saw the other day something about there were some regrets, at least among the police, that the drinking age had been lowered to 18. So is that simplifying life, to lower the drinking age to 18? Is it more natural? So, in a way, people are kind of groping, maybe a bit blindly, for a more natural, simpler way of life. And this is what Prabhupada was proposing to do. If you put Krishna at the center, if you put the core back in, if the root is spiritual, then you can have a more simple and a more natural way of life, which is what a lot of people want, a more simple way of life. And Prabhupada also was very strict about devotees having Harinam to teach and encourage the Sankirtan movement, congregational chanting of the holy name of God, as revealed in the teachings of Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. One time, I think I mentioned this, that Raya Rama, who was the editor of Bhakti Godhead, said, I can't do both. I can't go on the street and I can't edit this magazine. And he wrote that, like that, to Prabhupada, and Prabhupada wrote back and said, well, you have to do both. But if you absolutely can't do both, then just go out on the street and chant. So it was very, very important to Prabhupada that this thousands of people hear the holy name, and they see the devotees chanting, and they see their expressions. And it was very important. And then he went on to say a lot of things. But it is a legacy of Prabhupada, the fact that he established ISKCON. And I heard this, someone said that a lot of people are eating Prabhupada's prasadam. In other words, they're trying to imitate a copy or leech or sponge or poach off ISKCON. That goes on. And it goes on with any institution, I suppose, that's successful. There are people that try to copy it or try to somehow or other. It's kind of like the big ships, and you have these what are they, barnacles? The little fish that swim alongside of it, something like that. It's kind of like that. It's one way of looking at it anyway. But there's another saying that I heard Prabhupada say once, that as the elephant caravan passes, the dogs may bark, but the elephant doesn't care for the barking dogs. So in a sense, although there might be a lot of apostates and copies and parallels and offshoots, it really doesn't matter. because, I mean,